The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome, folks, once again to Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. And every Sunday at this time, we get to talk sports with some of the most interesting people in the profession. So we're glad you're with us. This is AM 660, The Answer, in Orlando. Jeff Sennis does our engineering every weekend, and Andrew Herdliska produces these shows for us, and we're grateful to both of them. Eric Musselman is the University of Nevada head men's basketball coach. He's been around basketball for decades, and I'm so glad that we can hook up here and have a nice little chat. Eric, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing great, Pat. It's great to catch up with you.
Eric, tell me about the name change. We know about UNLV, and it used to be Nevada Reno. Now it's just University of Nevada. What was the behind all that?
As is everything in life, branding, and I think that it's got, certainly from an athletic standpoint with our recruits, the name Nevada just pops. There's great pride amongst our campus, and that's what we are. We're the University of Nevada. We're no longer UNR, and everything in the athletic department, in the academics, it's all about representing the entire state of Nevada.
Eric, your background is fascinating. First of all, I want you to tell me about the influence of your father, Bill Musselman, on you as a coach and as a young man.
Well, Pat, since my dad's passed away many years ago, I always reflect back on, what stood out the most, if I could define it in a few words, and it's energy, effort, enthusiasm. And in those three words, he would constantly talk to me about, when I played youth basketball or youth baseball, it was never about how many hits you got or how many points you scored. It was always about how much energy did you play with, how much enthusiasm did you have with your teammates and coaches, and those type of things, and how much effort did you put forth. So I think those three words, and it's interesting, we just put those three words up in bold, huge letters in our locker room so that our players see that on a daily basis. Because I think in any walk of life, those three things, if they're embedded in you, you will be successful. And those things, those three words stand out. If I had to define what my dad taught me, in a very brief moment, it would be that, and he was my idol. I looked up to him. I wanted to walk in his shoes, and I feel so fortunate. There's only been a couple father-son head coaches in the NBA, myself and Mike Malone and his dad, and again, it's a short list that's been able to do that, and now J.B. Bickerstaff and Bernie, and we're part of that group that's had the chance to be head coaches.
Tell me about your memories of being here in Orlando with the Magic.
Well, one, Pat, I remember you coming down and working out, taking breaks, 10-minute breaks, and getting a quick lift in the weight room. But my time in Orlando as a really young coach trying to break into the business, the greatest thing about that was, I'm not saying it because we're on the phone, everyone in the sports world knows your leadership had such a heavy influence on me, reading all the little articles that you would put out. I remember getting photocopies of snippets of what you had read from books that were important.
Mm-hmm.
Being around someone like Chuck Daly, who to this day, constantly things are coming to my mind whenever there's a dilemma, anything that needs to get advice, I seek back to people like you two guys and things that I've either read from you or heard out of the mouths. And then to be around somebody like John Gabriel, who I thought was an unbelievable leader. And then having a chance once Coach Daly retired to work with Doc Rivers, So four people that had so much influence on my life in just under 2 years and just with one organization, that might have been the most impactful 2 years of all the time that I've been coaching because of the people that I was surrounded by.
Mm. What do you remember about Doc Rivers?
Well, obviously the time in Orlando, it was Doc's first time coach. And he did an unbelievable job with that group led by Darrell Armstrong, and the team overachieved. But I think the biggest thing that I took away from Doc, I could not believe the rapport that he had with the media. I thought that, you know, after a loss, he handled them perfectly. After a win, he handled them perfectly. He mixed in humor. He understood the big picture, which to me is fascinating for a first-time coach, because any of us, the first time we go through this, we all feel pressure and insecurities, and there's so many things that go through your mind as a first-time coach. And then the ability that Doc Rivers had to communicate with players, whether it be on the airplane, pre-practice, post-practice. I remember one time during practice, prior to it starting and the whistle blowing, guys were just shooting and laughing and talking, and I was all antsy and said, "Doc, are we going to ever get started in practice?" And he said, "Hey, chill out. This is called basketball bonding." And when he said that, many years later, I reflect back and think, how cool that he understood that that basketball bonding and the guys getting along was more important than anything we could do that day with X and O's.
Tell me about becoming the very young head coach of the Golden State Warriors, Eric. What was that like?
Well, Pat, you know, I remember there was a feature article that came out very shortly after I had gotten the job, and my phone rang, and it was Coach Daly.
Mm.
And Coach Daly kind of chewed me out, and he said, "You better stay out of the limelight.
Mm.
It's always about the players." And that sticks to me to this day, you know, the fact that he was trying to warn a young coach to get back, you know, to always put the players out in front of everything. But that year, you know, I remember we started off training camp, Pat, and I wanted our team to have a defensive identity. One of our assistant coaches was Hank Egan, and Hank Egan coached me in college. He coached Mike Brown, the former Cavs coach and Lakers coach. He was the college coach of Coach Popovich. And Coach Egan actually worked for Coach Popovich, Mike Brown, and myself. So he worked for three guys that he coached. But after our first exhibition game, I'll never forget it, in Missoula, Montana, against Seattle Supersonics, we won 75-76. We got back on the bus. I was extremely happy, and Coach Egan said, "I need to come to your hotel room, Eric." He came up to the hotel room, and he said, "Hey, look, this is not going to work." I said, "What do you mean, Coach? We just won a game. We played great defense." He goes, "We got to have an identity of being an offensive team. We're not going to make the playoffs. You've got to make this an exciting brand so you can create interest amongst fans, season ticket holders, media, and then we got to get a free agent or two, and the only way to do that was to play at a faster pace." I said, "Well, how are we going to do that, Coach? We've just been all training camp talking about defense." And he goes, "That's why they paid you the head coach dollars, me the assistant coaching dollars. You figure it out, but you better figure it out."
Mm.
And lo and behold, we ended up finishing second in the NBA in scoring. But again, older veteran leadership voices are so important, especially for a first-time coach, and I know that being my first time in Golden State as a head coach, to lean on a guy with such expertise was life-saving.
What did you learn from Mike Fratello as an assistant in Memphis?
Well, Coach Fratello was the greatest post-trap defensive teacher I've ever been around. And there was that one aspect that I thought he did better than anybody. Anytime the ball got thrown in the post from a defensive standpoint, we were trapping off the strong side elbow. The rotations that we had, everybody knew them like clockwork. I've never seen anything like it. It was drilled every single day. And then on our first day of training camp in Memphis, can't really call it training camp because Coach Hubie Brown had retired. Coach Fratello came in. in November. I came in with him. That first practice, he tested the players throwing the ball inbounds underneath full court, baseline out of bounds, half court, three-quarters court, and he told them which spot of the backboard he wanted the ball thrown on. And so he tested to try to know who was going to be our best inbounder in all those different scenarios that could happen in a late game situation. And to this day, we still do that. And I thought, unbelievable, all the coaches I've been around, I had never been around anybody that believed so strongly in the importance of the inbound passer.
Eric Musselman is our coach, University of Nevada head men's basketball coach. Eric, you were also the head coach of the Sacramento Kings. What was that experience like?
Well, Pat, that was a really difficult experience for me. And again, we always learn in any environment that we go into. So in Golden State, they were coming off, you know, some very, very poor seasons. We were the most improved team in the NBA that year in Golden State with a 17-game improvement. Then I come from being an assistant in Memphis and get the Sacramento job, and that was a team that had made the playoffs for seven straight years under a great coach in Rick Adelman. They had a system. They believed in the system. Mm-hmm. They believed in one another, but they did make a coaching change, and it was really, really hard to replace a really good coach. And I learned really quickly the importance of what jobs you take, the perception of where an organization is, and sometimes it's better to pass up a job than take a job. And again, I think that all of us in our coaching profession want to jump at jobs instead of trying to sit back and have patience. And I would say that the one word as a 51-year-old coach that I never would have uttered 10 years or prior to that is the word patience, because we always want the first available job. And if I had to look back and said, hey, we had two pretty good years at Golden State, I was around great coaches like Coach Daly and Mike Fratello and Lon Kruger, Doc Rivers. If I just would have been patient, maybe a better fit would have happened for me than what happened in Sacramento.
Eric Musselman is with us, the longtime coach. Boy, he is seen it all. We've got more with Eric right after these messages on Inside the Game with Pat Williams. It's AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. Eric Musselman is with us, a lifetime college and pro basketball coach, the son of the late Bill Musselman. Eric, I'm fascinated with pieces of your career. So you've been a head coach twice in the NBA, then suddenly you're coaching the Reno Bighorns and the Los Angeles Defenders. You're an assistant at Arizona State and an associate head coach. You're an associate head coach at LSU. How would you describe yourself? A basketball lifer?
Well, I will say, Pat, after being let go by the Sacramento Kings, probably the best thing that ever happened in my career or life is I took 3 years off to reconnect with my two sons. After a difficult divorce, to go with my sons, be a dad, attend all their games, take them to school, wait in carpool lane to pick them up. The greatest 3 years of my life was hanging out with those two sons and reconnecting. And then,
how are they doing now, Eric? How are they doing now, and how old are they, and what are they up to?
They are doing great. My one son is a sophomore at the University of San Diego, which is where I went.
Mm-hmm.
He's a manager on the basketball team, wants to get into coaching. Couldn't be more proud of him from an academic and a social standpoint. And then my other son just finished the freshman year at Monta Vista High School. He's a very good basketball player, a good student, and a great brother to my daughter. And so both those guys I'm so proud of, Pat, but after taking those 3 years with them, I got remarried, and my wife said, you got to go back to coaching. And so I went and coached the D-League in Reno. Great experience to get my feet wet. You know, it's like riding a bike. You don't forget how to ride it, but, you know, when you're away for 3 years, I felt rust those first 10 or 15 games and eventually felt comfortable again, and then got a little bit better opportunity, better paying with a organization that was directly connected to a D-League team with the Los Angeles Lakers. And with the Lakers D-League team, you play and practice in the same practice facility as the Lakers. So that was great to be around Kobe Bryant, see his work ethic, work around somebody like Mitch Kupchak on a daily basis. And then when I didn't get a call back to the NBA, I decided, you know what, I'm going to go the college route. Went to Arizona State to learn the college game. It kept me close enough to my two sons. It kept me on the West Coast because my wife at the time was working for NFL Network, so she could fly from Phoenix back to L.A. And then after the 2 years at Arizona State, I had a tough decision. Flip Saunders called and offered a job with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Flip played for my father at the University of Minnesota, and we had been friends for many, many years. And LSU and I had been talking, and so I had to make a a career-altering decision. Do I go back to the NBA, or do I continue with this path that was trying to lead me to get a college head job? And so I decided to go to LSU with Johnny Jones, who I had no prior relationship whatsoever, but I knew that he had a reputation of being an unbelievable recruiter, and I felt like that was the one hole in my resume that I needed to fulfill to become a college head coach. So I went to LSU. They had one of the greatest recruiting classes ever with Ben Simmons, Antonio Blakely, and then got the job here at Nevada. So an interesting decision, Pat, if I fast forward 24 months ago, was to go to the Timberwolves or to go to LSU. And as Chuck Daly said, every decision's 50-50, baby. You never know.
Oh, my. I wrote a book a few years ago after Chuck's death, Eric. I don't know whether you got it or not. It's called Daily Wisdom.
And I've read it several times, Pat. Not once, several times.
Yeah, all of Chuck's famous sayings. I'm glad you got you caught up with that book. That captured our dear friend Chuck, I think, beautifully. I had a good time putting that together, Eric. What's the difference between coaching in the pros and in college?
You know what, Pat? There's so many differences. If we just talked about, all right, what's the difference between a college coach and a pro coach coaching, meaning X and O's? Well, first of all, in the NBA, baseline out of bounds is not very important, but you better be a unbelievably great side out of bounds coach, both offensively and defensively. In college, because of the rules, when the ball goes out of bounds, 90% of the time, Pat, the ball is inbounded on the baseline instead of side out. Where that ball gets knocked out in an NBA game, it goes out on the side. So a drastic rule difference that drastically alters how you coach. So that's one thing. And then in the NBA, the four mini games, meaning four quarters, there's always decisions at the end of each of those quarters. In college, especially in late game, Pat, I wish they would change the rule in college where you can call a timeout and advance the ball, because there's much more coaching when you can do that in the NBA, advance the ball, rather than in college, how many times you just see full court luck shots or not really a scheme in the college game, late game, whereas the NBA, the last 2 minutes, there's a lot of X and O's that go on. And then obviously an 8-minute game, in the NBA, it's 8 minutes longer. So a 40-minute college game as opposed to a 48-minute NBA game alters drastically how many players you need to play during the course of a year, because it's 30 games as opposed to 82. So in the NBA, you might need a depth chart of 10 quality players. In college, we survived this year with seven guys that we relied on because there's 2 and 3 days, 4 days between games. Guys are rested. Much more in the college game. So those are some of the in-game stuff. And then off the floor, drastically different. We have guys over to our house all the time to eat dinner. We have team meals at my house. My wife knows the players, not just from basketball stuff, but she's part of their lives off the floor, meaning guys will come and say things and seek advice, and you're developing young men to go into the real world. So there's so many differences. Positives and negatives to both sides. I would say that, you know, any coach to have any success at the collegiate level has got to be an unbelievable recruiter. You got to enjoy recruiting. However, there's a lot of things that are difficult in recruiting. for instance, for, you know, when you bring a recruit in, you know, it's 48 hours constant with the family, and then you could have another recruit come in that next day, and it can become challenging when you do that during your entire off season.
Tell me about your experience with a very young Jeremy Lin.
Well, it was really interesting, Pat, because Jeremy was with the Warriors and wasn't getting many minutes, and he was sent down. I think the first couple days he was really apprehensive because he was a rookie. He was from the Bay Area, grew up there, was always a Warriors fan. His family lived in San Jose, so it was really comfortable even though he wasn't playing. Well, after that first game of going from DNPs to not even being on the active roster with the Warriors to playing 30-plus minutes, he found out really quickly, hey, this D-League stuff's pretty cool. I get to play through my mistakes. And Jeremy actually did not want to get called up. But the biggest thing that we helped Jeremy or was a part of Jeremy's career, Pat, was he really wasn't a point guard. He didn't see the floor, especially he was a predominantly right-hand dribble-drive guy and did not look to the left side of the floor when guys were coming off down screens or if there was help from the left side. He didn't recognize that, so we tried to show him through video, and then we tried to improve his ball handling with his left hand, and obviously now he gets to the rim really, really well. And shortly after his time in Reno, Linsanity happened, and so it was really, really interesting to see how a player who believes in himself and has confidence can conquer the world in his own eyes, and that's what happened with Jeremy.
Eric Musselman, our guest. Eric, how would you describe Reno, Nevada, to one who's never been there?
Well, it's a really, really unique area because of where we are located geographically. We're only 3 hours from San Francisco and 3 hours from Oakland. We're an hour and 45 minutes from Sacramento. Mm. And if you go on those drives to either of those places, which I do it about once a week to see my son in the Bay Area play his high school games and summer league stuff, what ends up happening for 40 minutes of that drive is the most beautiful spot maybe in the world as you go by Lake Tahoe and through the Nevada Sierra Mountains. And so it's incredible. You can be in Reno, and it could be 65 degrees and sunny, and you drive 35 minutes up past Truckee and get to the Lake Tahoe area and Donner Summit, and all of a sudden you can be in a blizzard. And it's happened, Pat, in the last year, it's probably happened 5 times where I'm either in Oakland playing pickup ball with my sons in shorts and a T-shirt, jumping my car back to Reno, and I find myself stuck trying to put chains on the car because they won't let you through because of snowstorm blizzard. And so you get a unique experience of everything from weather-wise to scenic as well. In this area, and then the campus is a campus that has 20,000 students, and so it's a really, really unique place to be right on the border of California.
Where do you recruit from, Eric?
You know, Pat, the thing that was the most interesting when this job became available was I said to myself, all right, where do I have a realistic chance to go into a prospective student-athlete's home and have an impact? And that was in Oakland, San Francisco, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and all those areas I've either lived at or spent time at. So that's our recruiting base for the most part, and then San Diego and Los Angeles. We've had great, great success in the L.A. market. And so I think that, you know, if you've been a part of the Lakers organization, if you've been a head coach of a Bay Area team like the Warriors and then a Sacramento, you know, our freshman all-league center, Cameron Oliver, was from Sacramento. And when I started recruiting Cam and tried to kind of explain to him my background, he said, hey, coach, hold up, man. My first NBA game, you were coaching the Warriors. Mm. My dad took me, so I know exactly who you are. And I think that that makes it unique for me, Pat, because if I was in another geographical part of the United States, probably don't have that same impact as I do where we're located.
Eric Musselman has been our guest. Folks, we're back with more right after these messages. You're listening to Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. It's AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. It's time for Inside the Game again, folks. I'm Pat Williams, your host, and every weekend at this time, we get to talk sports with some of the more interesting people in the country. Jeff Sennis does our engineering. Andrew Herdliska does the producing. And my first guest, Chet Kopic, Eric Musselman, our guest in the first half hour, and the basketball coach. And now Chet Kopic is here for our second segment. And so glad that we can visit with you, Chet. I hope things are well.
Pat, it's great to hear your voice. If I can embarrass you for a moment or two, I want to tell your listeners throughout Central Florida that 47 years ago this August, a chubby little kid named Chet Kopic, who had just turned 21 years of age and was working as a reporter at the Fox outlet here in Chicago, met this precocious 29-year-old general manager of the Chicago Bulls. And I recall, Pat, we were over at LaSalle and Wacker in the Bulls' old offices, and that very same day that you took the job, you began with a bang by bringing Chet Walker, one of the most popular players in franchise history, into Chicago. And, Pat, I was thinking that one of the first great promotions you had during that maiden voyage with the Bulls, and really, people should understand that you saved the Bulls because they were on life support in Chicago, but I do recall this vividly, that one of the first promotions you had paid tribute and honored a man who was an idol of mine and will always be an idol of mine, and that is Bill Veeck. Pat, I'm the last guy here in Chicago who remembers. Pack him in tight for Bill Veeck night.
Oh, Chet. Yeah, and the great Bill Veeck came, and we honored him, and we had some good fun that night.
Oh, we sure did.
Your memory is terrific, Chet. And before we got so many things to cover, but a while back, you put together an interesting book with Triumph Books right there in Chicago. Doug Buffone, Monster of the Midway, My 50 Years with the Chicago Bears. What was that book about, Chet?
Well, Pat, what I tried to do was this. You know, during the 1960s, and of course, you know, when you were here with the Bulls during the late 60s into the early 70s, before you made the move down to Atlanta, you recall the Bears were at a very, very low ebb, the lowest ebb arguably in franchise history. But there were, you know, two players of remarkably significant note on the club, one being Gale Sayers and the other being linebacker Dick Butkus, both Hall of Famers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this linebacker out of Yatesboro, Pennsylvania, a mining town that turned out, you know, so many great football players. I mean, quarterbacks, well, it's like quarterback you out in Western Pennsylvania. But I never felt like Doug got the credit he deserved for being a prolific linebacker. He never played in the Super Bowl. He only went to the playoffs twice in a 14-year career with the Chicago Bears. And I think because of the presence of Dick Butkus, he never got the attention he deserved. So I thought, you know, here is an opportunity to bring to light with a guy who's candid, very, very honest, a career that was painfully overlooked. And Pat, you know, you've been in the game as many years, if not longer, than I've been, and you've seen those athletes who have something to bring to the table, but they just never get what they deserve. And Doug, being Doug, was reluctant at first to write the book, but once we finally got him to settle down, he paints a remarkable portrait of what pro football was like during what was still very much a growing up era for the NFL. He's very honest. It's a book that is not meant to take any prisoners. It's a book that's really, Pat, meant to make people laugh, give them some insight about what the league was like. And, yeah, he does talk about the fact that, you know, greenies and uppers were so prevalent, and talks about the fact that medical supervision and medical treatment in those days was just so virginal. I mean, my gosh, Pat, this is a guy who once went out and played a game, if you can imagine this. He played a game with Legionnaire's disease.
Mm.
The Bears told him he had the flu. Mm. And, you know, he told him before the game, I don't think I can last. He collapsed on the second play.
Mm.
And then went back in the ball game later on and kept on playing. He was on the field in Detroit at Old Tiger Stadium in 1971 when the NFL suffered the sorriest day in league history when Chuck Hughes collapsed and died on the field. there are remarkably interesting stories about Butkus, about Gale, about George Halas, all familiar names to football fans. So, again, you know, it's a book I'm remarkably proud of. I'm proud to have had the opportunity to write the book. And so, Patrick, now that I've done the plug, let's move on to important things.
Triumph Books put it out, my 50 years with the Chicago Bears. Doug Buffon, Monster of the Midway. What's the state of the Bears now, Chet?
Well, they're, once again, my gosh, Pat, it's a franchise that, you know, the term Monster of the Midway could actually be declared a misnomer with this franchise, given the fact that the Bears have only won two championships over the last 68 years. And, you know, they won the one Super Bowl back in 1985, and in many respects still live off of that Super Bowl. And there are anniversaries all the time for the 85 team. This is a club right now that, are they as good as the Green Bay Packers? No. Are they as good as the Vikings? Are they as good as the Lions? No. But, you know, Chicago being such a rabid football town, Patrick, is, as you well know, I mean, you know, people right now figure the Bears are going to go 16-0 and then 3-0 in the playoffs, and we'll have a Michigan Avenue parade. Jay Cutler is still their quarterback, who likely, Pat, will go down in history, although the honor may well be bestowed upon Derrick Rose. Jay Cutler will likely go down as being the single most disappointing athlete during the modern era of Chicago sports.
Just because their expectations were so high for him?
Well, Pat, you know, I mean, imagine this as a promoter. And I also want to bring to light that, you know, the job that you did promoting basketball in Chicago, again, you saved, and I know how humble you are, you saved the franchise. You brought basketball to Orlando. What I've always admired most about Pat Williams and what made me so intrigued about your personality, and I would have loved to have written your book, is the fact that you're one of those guys who just has the magic, just has the magic touch. And, you know, you're one heck of a guy, Mr. Williams. You really are.
Well, thank you, Chet.
It's been an honor. It's been an honor to know you and be around you and learn from you and just to have the opportunity to watch you operate. And, Patrick, how many people remember that when the ABA and the NBA finally got on the same page and it looked like McGinnis was going to be stolen by the New York Knicks, how many people remember that Pat Williams fought the great fight and brought that big, tough hunk of power forward leather into Philadelphia? It was Pat Williams.
That was quite a time, Chet. 1975, if you can believe
right.
It. My goodness.
Now, also, Pat, you know, I want to mention this. You opened the door to so many people to Christianity with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. In other words, I mean, do I dare say, at the risk of embarrassing you, that you've always been a hero to me? You know, when I met you, I was 21, and, you know, you were at a very impressionable age, and I thought, here is this good-looking guy, and he's only 29, and he's general manager of the Chicago Bulls. So, you know, Pat, please tell me the check is in the mail.
Chet, I do want you to talk about the Cubs and the new Wrigley Field and all that's going on the north side.
Pat, you would love this right now. It's a terrific ball club. It's a very deep ball club. I would think the only thing that prevents them from going deep into the playoffs would be a significant injury to either Jake Arrieta or John Lester, one of their two pitchers. It's a club that from time to time, you know, Pat, think about the Yankees with Madeline Maris back in the day. Think about the Big Red Machine. It's that kind of ball club where you just have the feeling that no matter how far behind you might be in the sixth inning, that something majestic is going to transpire. And the club is playing on a remarkable high right now. It's a team that is still, you know, vulnerable to a certain extent. Anybody can be beaten. I mean, you can have one run where you lose, you know, 15-20, and the Pittsburgh Pirates catch fire, and all of a sudden you've got a derby. But, you know, right now I would think, Pat, that this club will probably send about six, maybe seven players to the All-Star game. It'll be a Cubs festival. I think it's going to cruise to a title in the National League Central. And, as for how far he will go in the playoffs and or the World Series, which, by the way, they have not won in, you know, good morning, 108 years.
Mm.
If you told me that Arrieta will pitch like Arrieta and John Lester will pitch like Lester and the bullpen will hold up, I would say that, you know, this town's going to have one heck of an October. They will win the World Series. I mean, right now, up and down Las Vegas Boulevard, I mean, they're the betting favorite everywhere you go. So, you know, for whatever that's worth. Also, Pat, you would like this. Joe Maddon is so remarkably entertaining.
Mm.
He is absolutely your kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
The two of you together would have been like Martin and Lewis. You know, I mean, would have been absolutely just wonderful working with each other because Joe, you know, for example, Pat, Joe does something which I think is absolutely novel and absolutely classic in terms of keeping the ball club loose. When the team goes on road trips, there's one rule. No ties. No sport coats. Every road trip is given a theme. Now, the theme on this current road trip is 1970s NBA basketball teams.
Mm.
So John Lester took care of the tab and got various warm-ups, probably from that place in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Had players' names stitched on the back. And the other day, they come marching out of Cubs Park on a Sunday, and they're all wearing 1970s NBA throwbacks. And I'm thinking about the old Baltimore Bullets, and I'm thinking about the NBA back in the day when, and you know, Pat, when you stop and think about it, don't you think it's a shame, as I do, that today's millennials and Generation Xers really don't know or have the opportunity to see just how tough and how competitive and how much fun it was back in the day with Norm Van Leer and Oscar Robertson and Jerry and Walt Frazier and Dave DeBuscher and the Dipper and Bill Russell, because it was such a magic era, Pat, and if the league at that time would have had the benefit of social media and the TV contracts available today, the growth of the NBA would have been sped up 25 years.
Chet Kopick, our guest from Chicago, the voice of Chicago sports for many years. More with Chet right after these messages. Inside the Game, I'm your host, Pat Williams. It's AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. Longtime Chicago broadcaster and network broadcaster, Chet Kopick is our guest from the Windy City. Chet, what is going on with the Bulls, and what does the future hold for them?
You know, Pat, right now it's quagmire. It really is. It's a bona fide quagmire. It's going to be very interesting to see what transpires over the next several months. I think the ball club right now would kill to move Derrick Rose in the remaining year on his contract. Conversely, there's a great deal of animosity within towards Jimmy Butler. Butler and Derrick Rose were supposedly going to work out with each other this summer. Their next workout together will be their first.
Mm.
It's a club which elected to, as you know, fire Tom Thibodeau, who I thought was a terrific coach, who reminded me a great deal of Red Holzman with his emphasis on defense and ball control. But he just wasn't management's guy, and they're certainly entitled to do whatever they want. But got the ball club underachieved last year, and I think, you know, what was most disappointing for Bulls fans here in Chicago, where, once again, the sellout, which you began to engineer in the late 1960s, is an absolute way of life. I mean, Bulls tickets still remain a very, very hot commodity. And where they're going, Pat, I don't think they make the playoffs this year unless something transpires dramatically in free agency or there's a trade consummated which changes the cosmetic of the ball club or they get lucky in the draft. I just don't think it's a very good club. Powell is getting older, and he just cannot defend the screen role anymore. Not that he really could defend it, 10 years ago. But you're paying him to be a scorer, so I guess there are no complaints. The Rose injury factor, Pat, and as a former general manager, you would certainly understand this, hangs and looms as a dark cloud over this franchise 24 hours a day.
Mm.
You just have that feeling of when is the next injury. How long is it going to take? And Rose, and you know, I give Derek a mulligan to a certain extent. He's a young kid. He came out of a brutally tough area here in the murder capital of America, if you will. I mean, we can't run from what we are here in Chicago, Pat. This is a very, very dangerous town. It's gotten progressively more dangerous. Pat, when you were here in the late 60s and early 70s, this town was Mary Poppins. This town was a bundle of joy. It's not like that now. I mean, good Lord, Pat, you know, over the past weekend with Memorial Day, you'd be shocked by the volume of murders and shootings we had here in Chicago. So anyway, getting back to Derek Rose. Derek Rose said last year, somebody asked him, you know, what are your goals right now with the Bulls? He said, to get a max contract. I mean, he couldn't have said anything worse. You know, you have a season to play. He said, I want to get a max contract. I mean, nobody in their right mind right now would give this guy a max contract. Also, defensively, because of the knee injuries, and I can't blame the kid for this. He really can't defend. There are other issues. Club has got to make a decision regarding what it's going to do contractually with Joakim Noah, who at one time was a candidate for NBA MVP honors, was Defensive Player of the Year, and above and beyond that, Pat, he brought a Jerry Sloan, Norm Van Leer type of spirit to the ball club that just you know, made the hair on your neck stand up. And sadly, because of just a myriad of injuries, Joe is not the player he used to be, and I have no doubt he will not be here next year. So right now, I'd like to tell you that it's a pretty picture, and it's going to be Michael Jordan against the Bad Boys, and it's going to be something that will be appointment television, but that's just not the case. Right now, as we speak today, two longtime buddies who've known each other almost a half century, I don't think they go to the playoffs.
Chet, does the aura and the memory of Michael Jordan still hover over the city of Chicago?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Pat. And, you know, mind you, it's been really a full generation since Michael played his last ball game, since he dropped that jump shot against Utah back in 98 to wrap up the Bulls' last NBA title. So, you know, 98 to 16, we do the math, that's 18 years that Michael has been gone. I thought the ball club made an egregious error in not trying to reconcile with Michael and keep him around in some capacity just to have his name value. But what's interesting, Pat, is sit down with a group of Bulls fans in a bar, you know, Gibson's over on Rush Street of the East Bank Club, and start talking about Bulls basketball, and you won't go more than 90 seconds before somebody says, yeah, but it just isn't like it was when Michael was here. And you know something else, Pat? And I would pose this question to you as a man who's forgotten more about basketball than I know. Isn't Scottie Pippen, in his own way, the most underrated player in NBA history?
No, you could argue that. You could argue that. Without Scottie, you know, they don't have all those trophies out there hanging up.
Oh, that's for sure.
Pat,
I think he's the greatest open court player I've ever seen.
Well, give our old friend the Sleuth some credit, right?
You know, I feel bad for the Sleuth, talking about Jerry Krause, the former GM. I mean, you know, Jerry's never going to win any awards for public relations, but as you know, nobody works harder than Jerry Krause. He's scouting baseball now, I believe, for both the New York Mets and the Houston Astros. And, you know, for example, Pat, if you look at the second run of the three-peat coined by Riles when the Bulls won in six, when they won 72 games, 7-8, a major component. They don't win those three titles if Jerry Krause doesn't have the guts to say, I'm going to take a chance on Dennis Rodman.
Mm-hmm. No, you got to give him a lot of credit through that era. Before we run out of time, I do want you to tell me about the White Sox, Chet. What's going on the South Side?
Pat, team in need of a facelift. Team right now in need of Pat Williams. From a marketing standpoint, from a player personnel standpoint, and I mean that sincerely. I mean, if I was Jerry Reinsdorf and I owned the Chicago White Sox, And I said, you know what? I want to change what my ball club looked like. I'd be on the next plane to Orlando in a private jet with a blank check and say, Pat, come up here and bail me out. Because the World Series you won in 2005 may as well have happened in 1715. We can't get the time of day in the papers or on TV and radio because of the incredible color and flamboyance of the Cubs. And here is the worst thing, and as a promoter, you can amplify on this much better than I can. Here is the worst thing that they face right now, Pat. It's become fashionable to say, I don't go to White Sox games. I mean, when you're in that position, we aren't talking about a project that's going to be resolved in 10 days. Pat, that's long term. I mean, for example, if I told you you could take over the Chicago White Sox, they're not drawing, their TV numbers are lousy, and the product on the field is bad, where would you start?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? Well, I think you've put that one in order. Chet, I need to get into a couple other quick topics in our closing minutes.
Sure.
Is Chicago still a great hockey town?
It's a wonderful hockey town. Pat, the city is in love with Patrick Kane and Jonathan Taves and Duncan Keith and John McGunnum, the president of the club, who was hired by Rocky Wirtz, the son of the late Bill Wirtz, has done just a magnanimous job of awakening a fan base that was dying to be given a wake-up call. And, you know, what I find interesting about John is that much like a young Pat Williams, he's on his game 25 hours a day. He's an endless stream of ideas, concepts, always thinking about what can we do differently. The events he's promoted here in Chicago, Pat, with the outdoor games, he's made the Blackhawks, Pat. I never thought I would see this happen in my lifetime. You know how big the Bears are in Chicago. I don't have to tell you that. Pat, it's now more fashionable to say, I have a ticket for the Blackhawks and the Detroit Red Wings than it is to say, I have a ticket for any Bear game except the Green Bay Packers. That's how big the Blackhawks have become here in Chicago. And, you know, it's a fun watch. It's been a great story to watch unfold. They've won three Stanley Cups over the last 7 years. They've done a remarkable job under the cap of retooling. And hey, by the way, I have a question for you before we say goodbye. And I just I can't tell you how honored I feel that you called up your old buddy. Does Ferguson Jenkins still say that the toughest guy to pitch to he knows is Pat Williams?
I run into Fergie. The last time I saw him, Chet, was at the NBA All-Star Weekend in Toronto this past February. And Fergie, Canadian, you know, was brought back as part of the tribute, you know, to all great Canadian athletes. And so I ran into him a couple of times. We had a wonderful visit. He's such a gracious, warm guy. And and he always, at Chet, he always introduces me, you know, whenever we're together. You know, he said, this is Pat Williams. He was my first catcher in pro ball. And I always feel very warmed by that. On the banquet circuit, you know, I tell the story, you know, of catching him one night. Uh-huh. And then after the game, the writer said, Fergie, who's the toughest man for you to pitch to in the Florida State League? And he said, my catcher, Williams. So we close on that note, Chet. I'm glad we could visit. We've had a wonderful half hour. Chet Kopick has been our guest from Chicago. Thanks for listening, folks. We're back next weekend for more Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. You're listening to AM 660, The Answer, in Orlando. Have a great week ahead.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn. deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.